we've been building worlds over the last several weeks, scenes, settings, characters, voice, dialogue, and then populating those worlds. Today we're going to take a step back and talk about the structure of a story, how you frame the material that has emerged from the writing exercises you've undertaken. Two wonderful videos by Andrew Sean Greer and Jonathan Leatham. Jonathan is the author of a diverse collection of books, most recently the novel Dissident Gardens. He teaches at Pomona College.
And Andrew Sean Greer is the author of a story collection and four novels, including The Story of a Marriage, which was a Washington Post Book of the Year and a Today Show Book Club selection, and most recently, The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells.
I thought I would talk about stories and storytelling, which may seem incredibly basic because it might be the first urge you have when you want to write a story. But it also, I find that a lot of advanced writers and even many published writers I know, we talk about storytelling is all we talk about. And they seem like they're going to be the same thing because what is a story without a storyteller, or the opposite? But, well, we all of us know like a great storyteller, like the grandpa or something, or maybe just one of our friends. Whenever we see them at the end of the day, they have some amazing story to tell. And you just think, how do all these great things happen to them? Where do they get these stories? You know, they must have gathered them over the years, and they're just so lucky that they have great things happen to them. Or maybe they're messed up, and they make great things happen to them. And I think two things are going on with those people. And one is, maybe they're instigating stories around them, but probably they're paying attention to absolutely everything, and they're filing it away as a possible story. So even the smallest incident on the subway or, you know, at buying food at McDonald's turns into a story because they were paying attention to the interaction and that it was funny to them. In the way that there's some people on Facebook always have some amazing picture of something they found on the street. It's not that they are walking down amazing streets, it's that they're paying attention. And then the other thing they're doing is that they either have the talent or they are working on being a storyteller. And that means that they are telling the story in a particular way. And that's what a writer has to figure out beyond just the impulse to tell the story, is to connect to the audience. And have them feel the impact of the story. And we've all done this in like joke telling, like, you know, where you're a kid and you hear some great joke and you try to repeat it and it doesn't work. And something feels unfair about the universe when that happens. And so you try it again on your parents and you try it again, you change it a little bit. And that changing a little bit is you figuring out how to tell the story properly and make the joke land and get the timing right, and you finally got a solid joke. And I have a bunch of jokes that I think are really funny and that no one ever laughs, and I'm clearly telling them wrong, and they're clearly just jokes for me, myself, not to share with others. And sometimes we write stories like that. They just don't connect, even though they're perfect, but they're just for us. And there is something beautiful in the immediacy of the story that we have an urge to tell, which I think when we're a beginning writer, there is some story, often our own story, that we are longing to tell. And to try to manipulate it in any way would sort of ruin the purity of it in some way. And if you have that story and that you have the luck to have that impulse, then by all means, put it down. But a lot of the time, what we need in order to tell a personal story best to connect with other people is to have a kind of distance. And that's why we think of, there's this funny thing happened to me today, and then there's this sad thing happened to me 20 years ago. You know, there's a difference. The comedy thing, it's funniest if it sounds like it just happened to you, but often when you read great works, they are looking, I sit here in the old age home looking back on. Well, that doesn't sound like a great book. But you know, but like To Kill a Mockingbird is not I'm a little girl in the South, but I remember that kind of town that's gone forever now and the things that happened to me then. And that distance allows the narrator, you, to tell the story any way you want, because if it's happening right now, it has to happen in the exact order it happens. But if you are looking back on the past, you can say, let me start further back, or let me start in the middle, or now I have to go back and tell you all about my brother. I was just this last weekend, I was up in a rural community in Canada where my nieces live in Argenta, Canada, which is this tiny little town of 50 people, 50 families, but 100 people. And they're not wired to electricity, and they're not wired to the water system. They do their own stuff and raise goats and have cheese. And I asked them about crime in their town. And my niece, who's 15 years old, she said, oh, this amazing thing happened to me. I found this scarf. I had this scarf stolen from me when I was walking down this path, and her dad said, wait, 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 let me tell it. And he said, long ago in the 90s, there was a professor in New Hampshire. And she's like, why are you starting back there? And he said, just wait, let me tell it. And he went all the way out of the town into New Hampshire and talked about this professor who had, I think he had done something terribly illegal, and he had fled with his two sons off to this small town, and then they were extradited. There was this long story that ended up with one of the sons with a pregnant bride in this small town, fleeing the Canada police who were trying to get her to a hospital, and they hid in the woods, and this scarf was stolen by this man in order to swaddle their new baby who they had in the forest. And that was the story. The story is not, I had a scarf stolen from me for a baby born. The story is the hardship and the tough path these people had and the strange choices they made and the kind of heartwarming Little House on the Prairie ending of swaddling the baby in the scarf, and who cares about the scarf, right? The story's not the scarf. And the dad knew that, and that's why he took it away from his daughter, even though it didn't happen to him. And I think that's the kind of patience and thoughtfulness that you take when you go to a story. One thing to do is to consider a family story of your own. You know, there's these family stories that are always told and that don't make sense to any outsiders because they don't know the people involved, and what they mostly don't know are the dynamics involved in the family. If you take a family story and you try to tell it from another person's point of view, it can be revealing. There was a family story that I never understood. It was about me, and when I was 4 years old, my grandparents from the rural South in the United States came to visit me, not me, my family, me and my twin brother and my parents, and we went to an Italian restaurant, which was a very outrageous thing to go to back then for them, and I think spaghetti was very exotic to them, and I ordered calamari, which was not common in the 1970s, and I was four, and I ordered squid. And my grandmother just could not, this was the funniest thing in the world, and she asked me how it tasted, and I said, happily, it tastes like rubber bands. And I don't think it's a funny story. I don't get it. But she would tell that every time I saw her until she died. She thought that was the funniest thing. And I thought, why is she telling that story? I mean, it was, said something about country city folk, I guess, maybe. And I wrote it down, and I wrote the story from the perspective of the waiter in the Italian restaurant, watching the family. And somehow that allowed me to have this other person imagine the dynamic in the family. And I discovered in writing the story that it was really my grandmother singling me out as someone she thought of as different, peculiar but special in the family, and that she was marking me by that story from when I was 4 years old. And maybe adventurous or something, and which delighted and scared her, and so that she didn't know why she liked that detail, but this waiter did, and I managed because of that outside view. And by telling the story, not when I was 4 years old, like I told you, I mean, probably you didn't laugh when I told that story, telling it out of order and looping back into the past of the characters as this waiter imagined them, and going back to them getting into the car in the snow and driving into the restaurant, telling it any way I wanted for what suited the emotion I wanted the reader to feel. And I will tell you, that's the first story I ever got published. I think part of it was that enough time had passed that I had read enough to know that stories could be made in different ways. Because when you first start reading fiction, the joy of it is to think that it just sprung out of the writer's mind directly, like a beam of light onto the page and inspiration. And it feels like that when you first start writing. And only after a long time do you realize that these people thought before they wrote down how they were going to tell it and the best way to do it. The point of view, the tense, the point of telling, which is how far in the future you are from when it actually happened, and the order of the sequence of events, they think about that before they put it down. And only when you realize that can you go back and maybe reread your favorite books. And this time not to be swept away by the magic of the storytelling and the Narnia lions and witches, but look at how it's told. And by that I mean specifically, technically, paragraph by paragraph, the order in which things occur, the transitions between an emotional moment and a description, and when dialogue shows up, and when it's just reported, we talked for about 2 hours about various things rather than 5 pages of talking about things. Those choices, which you could have in multiple sessions here about what all those are, but the first stage is just to start reading your favorite books, rereading them, this time looking at how it was made, the way that a carpenter would go into a shop or a museum and look at the way something's made so that they could imitate them it themselves. And I think there is caution always in trying in imitating other writers, because we're ourselves, we're expressing ourselves, and we want to just be, we don't want to be an imitation of another writer. But we, if you do that, you end up reinventing the wheel, and you'll end up picking up a book that figured something out, technically, that you've been working on for months. And I always look at my bookshelf. If I'm having a trouble with my writing, I look at the bookshelf and I think the answer is here somewhere. And if I'm attuned enough, I can look along the bookshelf and pick out the books I think it might be in. And I read those books, and if it's not working for me, then I toss it aside. But the important thing is, I don't think it's bad for a beginning writer to specifically and purposefully imitate a writer they admire, as long as they know they're doing it and they signal to everyone that they are doing it, just to see what that writer's doing and kind of trace what they're doing. And the next step would be just to look at their technique and notice that you're allowed to take that technique, because they didn't necessarily invent it, they used it. For instance, one that I've taken a lot is, I think I read it in A Handful of Dust by Evelyn Waugh, which is to withhold an important piece of information. Like you would say, like, she leaned down and then she told me something that would change my life forever. I walked out of the room and went into the winter night and looked at the, and you're like describing this long thing and the reader is like, what was it? And you are creating suspense that doesn't actually exist in the moment. It only exists in the way you're telling it. And he walks down the winter sky, remembering the thing she said, you know, I will never love you, or whatever it was. But if I realize that if you withhold it, you create sort of artificial suspense on the page for the reader waiting for the story to be fully told. And now it's a crutch, I shouldn't use it too much, but it was one of the first moments when I saw how something was made, and I thought it was delightful that the storytelling was better than the story itself. And I think once you start reading books and listening to good storytellers for how they put it together, you can take on those skills and start to make your own storytelling style with its own technical quirks and interests, influenced by all the writers that you love, even writers you don't love but who you admire their techniques. And then your bookshelf is like all of your great professors. You don't actually have to take year-long graduate courses. You really just have to read as many books as you can, paying attention to how they're made. And if you do that, then you become your own storyteller, and you're able to take the stories that happen to you by paying attention to the world and make them into something that connects with the people who read.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Leatham, and what I'd like to talk to you about today is a concept for generating stories and for thinking about structure in fiction, whether it's short stories or novels, based on two keywords. And if I had a chalkboard behind me, I'd write these words behind me, and you'd be staring at them this whole time. Instead, I'll just repeat them a lot to underline them. The two keywords are juxtaposition and causality. Now, I've arrived at this as something that I like to talk about with writing students over a long period of talking with students, many of whom are looking to understand why their own desire to write, their own first efforts or intentions to write, don't animate, don't come to life for them. They have difficulty starting stories or feeling that their projects are rich enough, active enough, complex enough to engage them, keep them interested, be persuasive. And I have gradually come to understand that one of the things that I most enjoy encouraging students to consider, and that seems to give them some of the best opportunity to go from intention to practice, is to talk to them about this idea of juxtaposition, first of all. That a lot of things that we like in writing, a lot of the stories that interest us, a lot of the novels that interest us, fundamentally take two unrelated things, two autonomous ideas, situations, possibilities, and shackle them. And in many ways, this initial impulse can seem quite arbitrary, because what you're taking are things that aren't necessarily related, and you're placing them together. That's the juxtaposition. And what takes this operation from being something sort of abstract or absurd or pointless is the second term of my concept, and that's the causality. You take the two unrelated things, the two ideas that each of which are inert and just sitting there, and you not only put them in the same place, you not only move them onto the page at the same time and make them part of the same story, part of the same project, but you insert a lot of causality. Now, so what's causality? Causality is basically the word because. It's the idea that these things that are coexisting in your story that might otherwise seem unrelated are not only going to be present at the same time, but they're going to flow one from the other. That one is going to cause the other, that they're going to be engaged actively as a kind of a problem, as a motive, that the stakes of the story are going to relate the two things urgently and extensively. So what do I mean by this? I'm going to give you an example from my own writing. When I conceived the book Motherless Brooklyn, which is a novel about a private detective who has Tourette's, it's also a book very much about my own childhood in Brooklyn and growing up in a certain neighborhood at a certain time and place. In some ways, it felt to me as though two different books were announcing themselves to me simultaneously. But rather than resist that or sort the two out or think they were incompatible, it seemed to me my funny sort of, you know, willful postmodern conceit about the detective with Tourette syndrome and my intimate, confessional, passionate love letter to the city where I grew up could be combined and ought to be combined. And not only shouldn't I do them at the same time, but that I was going to make it seem necessary. I was going to make it seem urgent and obvious in a way that that the only place where this detective with Tourette's could tell his story, the only place he could have come from, was Brooklyn. And, you know, once I make this assertion, so I've got my juxtaposition, right? Tourette syndrome, the hard-boiled detective story, and the autobiographical material, this really involved setting, time and place that mattered enormously to me. The public schools I went to, the streets I walked, the you know, slices of pizza I used to eat on Smith Street, the things that reminded me of growing up in that place that I suddenly wanted to say a lot about. So there's the juxtaposition. I mean, you could even argue it was a triple juxtaposition, because what are, you know, hard-boiled detectives and Tourette syndrome doing together? But anyway, so I've smashed these things into one project. And then I've taken the next step. I've inserted the causality. I've said, well, okay, so the reason that he functions, the reason a kid growing up embarrassed, awkward, confused with Tourette syndrome is recognizable to these tough guys, to these hoodlums and wannabe private detectives that he falls in with in the plot of the story, is that he becomes emblematic to them of Brooklyn. He seems to them to exemplify something that's already true about this place, which is that language is exploding everywhere, that because of the varieties of classes and cultures and races that we're all living together in Brooklyn, and the kind of frenetic, sardonic, intense, sometimes very insulting street language that was typical, you know, that typically arose in these confrontations between different kinds of people living in the same places, that his Tourette syndrome just seems like Brooklyn raised to the nth degree. It's like, you know, the two things have been made one. And so when my character meets the guys who will turn him into a part of this crime story, they find him fascinating, amusing, and not at all inappropriate they see him as symptomatic of their own reality, of their own milieu. And so in that way, I've kind of taken things that, you know, on their face, there's no logical reason they belong in the same story. But I decided to make the book, in a sense, an exercise in proving that the hard-boiled detective with Tourette's and Brooklyn were going to be synonymous. So my juxtaposition became loaded up with all sorts of causality. It became inextricable. And this is a method I recommend to you. And I think it can be done at a lot of different levels. It can be done with different kinds of ideas. It can be done with characters and setting. And the practical method that I would recommend to you, if you're sitting waiting for inspiration or feeling that, you know, you have certain kinds of material that seems incomplete or interesting, but you don't know how to begin it, or you have an idea for a voice, or you have an idea for a character, I almost always think the best move is to take one and another, perhaps even more than two, and put them in the same place and demand that they relate. Because energy is created by this demand and by the what may seem a rather mechanical procedure of inserting causality into things that are not logically linked. And this is where, you know, this is where a lot of what's most fascinating in storytelling, this is where a lot of the energy comes from, is that things that you wouldn't think of as being compatible or coexisting or related to each other have been electrified, like the parts of Frankenstein's body by the bolt of electricity. I'll give you another example outside my own work. One of the most grandiose, of course, is, you know, is the totemic book of modernist genius is James Joyce's Ulysses, which takes Homeric myth, takes Odysseus wandering home after the Trojan War, and relates it to the events of a day in a neighborhood in Dublin. Now, you know, we take this for granted now, of course. Well, it's Ulysses. Those things belong together. But when Joyce conceived this, they had no relationship. It was the bolt of electricity that he flowed between them that made them into one unified thing forever. And, you know, now we take it as a commonplace that these things are married together. You know, and I think the energy in the book, the humor in the book, the fascination, the genius, comes in many ways from the effort of justifying this conflation, of taking these two incompatible, you know, in this case, almost ridiculously incommensurate subjects and just knitting them together into some kind of other entity. And, you know, it's like a It's like a sculptural project. You know, can I make something out of clay and styrofoam? Can I smash together, pencil shavings and electrical wire? When people talk about, where do writers get their ideas? You know, was it the character or was it the setting? Did you think of the voice first, or were you more concerned with the plot, with the set pieces? Were you thinking about a theme, or were you thinking about things in your life, people you wanted to write about? The answer is almost always, when you press a writer and they have time to expand on what they were doing, the answer is always more than one. It's always both. And I think that you can seek this doubleness, you can seek this complexity by looking for things in your own notebooks, in your own inspiration, in your own fledgling efforts, maybe your own unfinished stories even, that are potentially, that are incomplete alone, but that if pushed together, if moved into a conjunction with these other things, might suddenly become something. You know, take an idea you once had for a milieu, a setting. You know, let's say, oh, gee, no one's ever written a short story set at the baggage carousel, you know, of an airport. Why is that? It's such a weird, in-between zone. So you've got this, and it's stuck in your head. Maybe someday I'll do something with a baggage carousel. But it just sits there, and you've got some other scrap or some other impulse. What if I, Uncle Fred, he's so weird. What if I dealt with Uncle Fred? What if his voice could somehow be, amplified or exaggerated and turned into that of a character? But that idea is also kind of just sitting there. It's inert on its own. Well, what might require doing is that Uncle Fred needs to go to the baggage carousel. Okay, that's a very kind of podunk example I've just given you. But I want you to look around for things that, have a little bit of itchiness, a little bit of stickiness, a little bit of energy for you, but haven't become stories, aren't active on their own. And try taking more than one of those and just relating them. You may have, you presumably will have, seen them as isolated. Well, now join them up and say, what kind of causality would justify putting them together? What gesture or trick of motivation or what plot hijink would be required to make these two things into one in a way that the reader would not only enjoy, but they would never dream of questioning, because they would seem organically part of the same reality principle. So again, juxtaposition, causality. It's the idea of making conflations and then justifying them. And that's what I've got for you.
Ian Forster famously said that a story is just sequential events. The king died and the queen died. But a plot introduces the element of causality. The king died and the queen died of grief. In the two videos you've just seen, you have Jonathan Lethem suggesting that we think of a new principle for generating plot: juxtaposition, surprising juxtaposition, and not just causality. You have Andrew Sean Greer thinking about the frame of storytelling, but then giving us an exercise in which we see a family story from a different point of view. What we'd like you to do is to take Andrew Sean Greer's prompt to remember a family story, remember it in detail, but now create a new setting for it, introduce something that did not happen into that story so that you create a divergence in the action.
This goes back to the time-honored tradition of fiction writing where the writer says, what if? What if this happened instead of that? Follow where that leads you and do it under 400 words.